This is VOA News by remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Weary European Union leaders finally clenched an unprecedented $2.1 trillion budget and coronavirus recovery fund early Tuesday. They somehow found unity after 4 days and as many nights of fighting and wrangling over money and power in one of their longest summits ever. To confront the biggest recession in its history, the EU reached a consensus of a 750 billion euro coronavirus fund to be sent as loans and grants to the countries hit hardest by the virus. That comes on top of the seven-year $1 trillion euro EU budget. At first, the grants were to total 500 billion euros, but the figure was lowered to 390 billion euros. U.S. President Donald Trump is acknowledging a big flare-up in COVID-19 cases, but divisions between the White House and Congress are threatening passage of a new federal aid package to deal with the pandemic. Republican congressional leaders met with Mr. Trump Monday at the White House as the virus worsens and aid isn't expiring. He says good things are happening, but the administration is stiffening its position to more testing money and interjecting other priorities. It could complicate passage. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he's prepared to roll out the $1 trillion package in a matter of days. The U.S. House has already passed a sweeping $3 trillion measure from the Democrats. And more than 609,000 people have now died from COVID-19 globally. It's approximately 141,000 in the United States and more than 80,000 in Brazil. And the number of infections globally is 14.6 million. And more than 3.8 million in the U.S., more than 2.1 million in Brazil. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. AstraZeneca's experimental COVID-19 vaccine has shown promise in its early-stage human trials. It was found to be safe and produced an immune response in clinical testing in healthy volunteers, with the strongest responses seen in people who received two doses. The vaccine is part of a collaboration between AstraZeneca and scientists at Britain's University of Oxford. It did not prompt any serious side effects and elicited antibody and T-cell immune responses. That's according to trial results published in the Lancet Medical Journal. The director of the Jenner Institute of Oxford, Adrian Hill, hopes a million doses might be manufactured by September. But that early estimate might be an underestimate, depending on how quickly late-stage trials can be completed. AstraZeneca is among the leading vaccine candidates against the pandemic, alongside others in mid- and late-stage trials. They have signed agreements with governments around the world to supply the vaccine should it prove effective and gain regulatory approval. The state of Texas has surpassed 4,000 deaths as a result of the coronavirus pandemic, but officials in Houston say they are cautiously optimistic about recent trends following weeks of alarming surges at hospitals. State officials reported more than 7,400 confirmed new cases and at least 62 new deaths. The virus continues taking a particularly hard toll along the Texas-Mexico border. Hidalgo County has reported more than 140 deaths over the past week, and the county judge on Monday signed a shelter-at-home order. Houston's health authority says hospitalizations appear to be tapering off a bit, but urged residents to continue wearing masks and avoiding large gatherings. South Korea's new virus cases have bounced back above 40. It's a day after it reported its smallest daily jump in local COVID-19 transmissions in 2 months. China is warning of consequences after Britain suspended its extradition treaty with Hong Kong in protest at a controversial new security law in the territory. London's decision threatened to put Sino-British ties under further strain days after the UK vowed to remove all Huawei 5G equipment from its networks and as British politicians criticized China for its treatment of ethnic minority groups. A statement on the website of the Chinese embassy in Britain criticized the suspension of the treaty and said the UK side has gone even further down the wrong road. Britain's extradition treaty suspension comes after similar tough action against China by the United States, Canada, and Australia. A foreign secretary, Dominic Raab, confirmed the widely expected move in Parliament Monday, despite repeated Chinese warnings that Britain was making a grave foreign policy error and risked reprisals. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Supporters of Ivory Coast ruling party are waiting for an answer from President Ouattara to see if he will run for a third term.
The executive director of the ruling party called Mr. Ouattara to run again because there is no any personality in the party who can keep the unity of the party and can help this party to win the next election.
A British charity provides computer tablets to less privileged students in Malawi. LGBTQ refugees in Kenya say they are being attacked. A new report says Zimbabwe's economic problems increase the risk of contracting COVID-19. And Zimbabwe police arrest a journalist and an opposition politician.
They have alleged that they both have been agitating and or encouraging citizens to go out in their numbers on the 31st of July to demonstrate against this regime.
Beatrice Mtetwa is the lawyer for Zimbabwe journalist Hopeful Chingono. And Africa may need to import as much as 20% of animal source feeds to meet demands in 30 years' time. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Of Ivory Coast, the ruling RHDP party are waiting anxiously to see if President Alassane Ouattara, age 78, will accept to be the party's candidate for the October 31st election. The ruling party is scrambling for a candidate following the sudden death of Prime Minister Amadou Gon Coulibaly and the resignation of Vice President Daniel Kablan Duncan this month. RHDP Executive Secretary Adama Bitogo said yesterday, Monday, that he had asked President Ouattara to run because majority of party supporters believe he can help the party avoid a bitter succession battle. However, Ivorian journalist Felix Boni says Ouattara cannot run because of age limitation, but if he insists on running, he could plunge the country into chaos.
The executive director of the ruling party called Mr. Ouattara to run again because there is no any personality in the party who can keep the unity of the party and can help this party to win the next election. The spokesperson of this party also wrote to Mr. Ouattara to be candidate because there is not any other possibility that only his application to the next election. Now we are waiting for the answer of Mr. Ouattara. Is he going to be a candidate again, or is he going to find another personality to be the next candidate? We are waiting for his answer.
Mr. Bitogo is saying that President Ouattara is the savior, or he's the only one that the party is depending on. Are there other people that the party can turn to?
You know, I think this position of Mr. Bitogo is a personal position because I think Mr. Bitogo is breaking for his own chapel so that he won't lose the position he has at this moment as a director, executive of the party, and also certainly one of the important personality in the direction of the campaign. Otherwise, there are a lot of personality in the ruling party who can be candidate, like the Minister of Defense, Mr. Ahmed Bakayoko, and also the Secretary of the President, Mr. Patrick Ashi. And there are other personalities. Mr. Ouattara is a little bit tired after the death of his prime minister. I don't think he must try to have another application to the next election and create another crisis which won't help him to go easily after his two mandate. I think the constitution will create problem on Mr. Ouattara's next application.
If President Ouattara is to run, does he have to change the constitution?
He cannot change the constitution now because this position in our area said that we cannot change the constitution 6 months before the date of the election. At this moment, we are at no more than 3 months before the election. We cannot change the constitution. And if Mr. Ouattara wanted to run again, he could have changed the disposition. You said that the president cannot make more than two mandates. In the new constitution, he changed the disposition, which said that the candidate must not be older than 75 years. If he does not, he did not change the disposition about the number of mandates, it means that Mr. Ouattara cannot say that he will be president and candidate again, because When we changed the constitution, he was already president for his second mandate. And the constitution is clear that the president cannot make more than two mandates. If Mr. Ouattara decides to run again, it won't be a best feature for the country. This position will lead the country to in another social political crisis again, because the opposition is waiting for Mr. Ouattara's answer before calling the supporters to different action about this situation. So I think the peaceful situation will be the position of Mr. Ouattara not to run again and to let another personality of his party run, because a different interpretation of the law will create another crisis in Cote d'Ivoire.
That was Ivorian journalist Felix Boni speaking with us from the capital, Abidjan. Zimbabwe police on Monday arrested a journalist and an opposition politician on allegations of incitement to participate in public violence. Beatrice Mtetwa, lawyer for journalist Hopewell Chigono, says police abducted Chigono from his home after they broke the front door glass to gain access. Mtetwa says police are alleging that Chigono and politician Jacob Ngarivome incited street protests next week, an allegation she says her client has denied.
Called in the morning around 10:30 to be told that police were surrounding his house. I managed to get out of court and rush to his house, and I found that the police had just left with him after having kicked in his glass door to gain entry and forcibly removed him, handcuffed him, and threw him in their car. And they took him to the police station. So we followed to the police station and went through the procedures of him recording a statement, which was done 5 hours after he had been arrested. When it was time for them to take him to the cells where they want to lock him up, together with the other guy who's been arrested, they then said they wanted to go and search for more equipment and or journalistic paraphernalia that he might have been using at his house. So we went to his house at around 8, and that's where we've been up to now, and they took whatever they wanted. But when they wanted to take his camera, we said absolutely not without a warrant, particularly because it is not in any way connected with the allegation that he has been communicating through social media.
Based on what I have read, journalist Chigono was arrested along with someone else, apparently a politician. What specific charges do the authorities have against him?
They have alleged that they both have been agitating and or encouraging citizens to go out in their numbers on the 31st of July to demonstrate against this regime. And they're alleging that he has been tweeting that people must demonstrate violently. He obviously has denied that. And we asked specifically for the tweets, which they say said that he was advocating for violence. The police were not able to particularize those tweets to give us the dates of when those were actually tweeted. So we don't even know what they're relying on. We have denied the charges completely, their entirety.
Are you seeking to get bail for him?
Obviously, we'll seek to have bail for him, but we don't know whether or not a bail will be opposed. We expect that it will be opposed so that he is inside until after the 31st of July. The law provides for a 48-hour period, which will expire on Wednesday morning.
Beatrice Mtetwa is the lawyer for Zimbabwe journalist Hopewell Chigono. She was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. Zimbabwe's economic problems increase the risks that people will contract COVID-19 because they often fail to comply with preventive guidelines while trying to make ends meet. This is one of the findings of a new report on the state of the country's human rights. Reporter Kuzaina Muzenge has details. The Zimbabwe Association for Human Rights, or ZIMRights, released its report, Rights in Crisis, a Human Rights Analysis of the COVID-19 Pandemic in Zimbabwe, during an online meeting bringing together experts, including medical doctors, lawyers, and human rights defenders. The report looks at incidents from the end of March to the end of June. It says 76% of the country's population depends on the informal sector for livelihoods. Some of the people interviewed for the report say economic problems, including shortages of basics such as mealie-meal, put them at a higher risk of contracting the coronavirus because they must flout health guidelines to eke out a living. The respondents said they expect the government to help them with grants, as is happening in other countries, but no aid has been made available. Zikamai Bere is the ZIMRights director.
The report recommends putting human rights at the center of the COVID-19 response, where it, you know, encourages the government to reflect on the fact that at the center of the fight against the COVID-19 are critical human rights issues, and that COVID-19 itself is a threat to the right to life, and that every other right in life is threatened when the right to life is threatened.
The report says Zimbabwe's health delivery system was already in a crisis when the pandemic hit. According to the report, many countries have used the crisis to boost their health systems, but Zimbabwe has no clear plan to do so. The report criticizes what it says is lack of transparency in the allocation of resources for combating COVID-19, as well as the country's reliance on donor funding, especially in the public health sector. The report says the government's failure to ramp up testing compromises the response to the pandemic, as there is no adequate data or information for guidance. Physician and former government minister Dr. Henry Madzorera thinks the report is important and government should take note of it.
There are many rights that should be observed by the government, which were highlighted in the report. The issue of water and sanitation and other social determinants of health. These are fundamental basics that help us and give us stamina to be able to deal with epidemics as they come. The rights of patients to health care and the rights of the health care workers themselves. We saw a very sorry situation in this epidemic, where healthcare workers were being forced to work without the necessary personal protective equipment. That is a violation of the rights of healthcare workers.
Lawyer and human rights defender Musa Kika says the report's findings are correct about rights abuses by government, especially during lockdown. He thinks the report will help citizens know and demand their rights.
We indeed have recorded several cases where soldiers and police officers have been harassing people in the streets, and that of course is illegal. We have cases where there is unwarranted use of force, but also cases where there is excessive use of force, that is disproportionate force. Citizens must know their rights. Citizens must be able to discern where their rights have been violated. And most importantly, they must be able to know what to do.
The report makes several recommendations to government, the private sector, and to civic societies. It emphasizes the need to strengthen the public health system, improve disaster preparedness, invest in and promote access to information, and invest in education technology, among others. Reporting for VOA from Bulawayo, I am Kudzanai Musengi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 21st. Students in Malawi, one of the poorest countries in Africa, have been out of school since March because of the COVID-19 pandemic. While most students have been able to study from home with lessons offered on internet or radio, many in poor and remote villages have been left out. A British charity, Voluntary Services Overseas, or VSO, has stepped in to bridge the gap by distributing solar power computer tablets with pre-programmed lessons to rural primary school students. Lamek Masina has the story.
The lessons begin with the voice of an instructor who tells students how to go about their assignments. All the content is in Malawi's main language, Chichewa, and helps students improve skills in reading, writing, and math. Parents say the intervention has eased their worry about the children's education, which spiked again after the government announced last week that it has suspended plans to reopen schools on July 13 due to a rise in COVID-19 cases. Olivia Maxson is one of the concerned parents. She says, "I lost hope, but with the coming of these iPads, we are very happy because now my children have something to do. They have stopped playing around," she says. "They are now learning. This will improve their education." Voluntary Services Overseas says that so far it has provided 1,000 tablets to learners in poor families who cannot access radio and television lessons, which government is currently providing. Yesani Kapanda is program manager for the VSO.
What happens is that the moment that the learner starts using them, there is what we call a diagnostic tools that places the kid at the right curriculum, depending on his or her levels. So, and then the kids start learning from there.
Kapanda says the learner's progress is monitored remotely.
We have put a SIM card in those tablets and we're able to monitor what is happening. If the learners are not using them, we're able to identify such households. We have also built a capacity of some teachers in those communities that are able to follow up from those households and provide any support that they may need as the learners are using these gadgets.
Shailene Joseph is a grade 4 student benefiting from the initiative in Lilongwe. She told VOA she enjoys learning through a tablet more than she would have learned through radio lessons. She says there isn't much practical work on radios, all the tablets are very interactive. She says we read, write, and sit for exams through tablets. Gosam Mafuta is the director of basic education in the Ministry of Education. He told VOA that although the tablet lessons are in line with the primary school curriculum, learners will not be assessed on these once the schools are reopened.
We're just bridging the gap, trying to make sure that we keep them engaged so that they don't forget the curricular materials they were interacting with. When they come, we're not going to assess them on that material. We'll actually begin again and try to find means on how we can actually bridge up those that we're not getting it, because we are mindful of the fact that not all our learners are getting these lessons.
VSO's Kapanda says the organization plans to distribute 5,000 more tablets, which will also have content for junior secondary school learners. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Lesbians, gay, bisexual, and transgender refugees say they are finding it difficult to stay in the Kakuma refugee camp because their safety is at risk. Some of them who live in the camp want to be evacuated after they said they were attacked, beaten late last month. Kenya's Refugees Affairs Secretariat says most of the people claiming to be LGBTQ plus came into the country as male or female and then changed their gender later. Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
The LGBTQ plus group and other people living in Kakuma refugee camp clashed, leaving others with injuries that led to arrest and prosecution of the attackers. The UNHCR, however, confirmed that the clashes at the Kakuma refugee camp are not new to them. Living in Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, a Ugandan native, Gilbert Turia Mureba, said that the local society does not accommodate the nature of their life, and most of them face attacks both in the camp and outside.
So by continuing to bring more LGBTQ plus persons in Kakuma, UNHCR and the Kenyan government in a way are encouraging these attacks, because the local population have made their position very clear. We shall not live with the LGBTQ plus persons. According to them, we are an abomination.
Gilbert says their efforts to have UNHCR evacuate them from the camp have not been successful.
The director spoke to us as a group and said, we're going to increase the supervision of police. We're going to make sure you're safe using the police patrols. Now, frankly, even though he tried, the attacks have increased. 10 days earlier, we had submitted a petition to Geneva asking for a safe place. All we wanted was a safe place.
A transgender woman, Doreen Andrews, was first attacked last year in Nairobi, then left for Kakuma refugee camp, where clashes erupted on 18th and 19th of June and was beaten alongside her colleagues, leading to dislocation of her shoulder. Doreen says she had to run for her life early this month back to Nairobi.
A group of about 25 South Sudanese boys attacked our compound. They hid me in one of the shelters. I thought my shoulder was just swollen, but it was dislocated. In Kakuma, the LGBT community that is there is living on a thread of life. No one is intervening. We have tried to call out to UNHCR. We have tried to call out to the police, but clearly they are done with us.
The UNHCR has confirmed that there is always clashes in Kakuma refugee camp and that LGBTQ attacks are common given the local Turkana community want to uphold their cultural practices. Kenya's Refugee Affairs Secretariat Codec Makori said that Doreen Andrews was first registered as a man when he came in the country in 2015 and that his LGBTQ claims are fake.
We don't have a refugee registered in the name of Doreen Andrews, but because we have dealt with this guy previously, we know him as Andrew Kigongo, and he is just one of those troublemakers in Kakuma who is always inciting people against the government of Kenya.
Mr. Makori said that the wish of the LGBTQ group having them relocated can only happen if they are being taken back to their country of origin.
Kenya is not in a position to relocate these people from here to any other country except probably to their home countries. On the issue of whether UNHCR is not taking good care of these people, that is not true. Many of these refugees have gotten all the support they need from UNHCR. If they think that they are not getting their rights in this country, they have a right to either go back or choose another country where they can get better treatment.
On 24th of May 2019, the High Court of Kenya refused an order to declare sections 162 and 165 that does not support gayism unconstitutional. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Africa risks needing to import as much as 20% of animal source feed to meet demands in 30 years' time if there is no innovation, according to a new report out from agricultural experts at the Malabo Montpelier panel. One of the panel experts, Noble Bananda, spoke to Ricky Stryak specifically about Mali and the solution it has seen, as well as the challenges that still exist.
One of the countries we focused on because of its good policies and what they have done. Just a brief background, Mali livestock contributes 40% of the agricultural GDP of Mali. Mali is one of the few countries in Africa that has a ministry for livestock. So I think that shows how seriously they take livestock. Besides setting up a ministry for livestock, Mali has also a center for genetic improvement for livestock.
What kind of barriers did you see in Mali? I know obviously there are, there are things going on in the north that are, it's some instability.
Of course, it's not only Mali. I think it's wide across the African continent. One, improvement of animal feeds, quality and quantity. It's critical. That needs to change. Then, of course, there are issues to do with land ownership, because land ownership, grazing lands, also touch with land ownership. But Mali is in a precarious situation, as you know now, that kind of political instability in parts of Mali. So I think that also affects not only humans, but also animals. And the report specifically talks about also the effects of climate change on animal rearing. People have to walk longer distances looking for pasture.
Why has this report come out? It's, I think it warns that in 30 years, Africa as a whole could have to import up to 20% of its meat and dairy needs. What does that mean, I guess, for the region?
Yeah, you see what is happening across the world is that as incomes improve, in Africa, incomes have improved. Lifestyles have improved, the rise of the middle class. So as incomes improve, also the diet improve. The diet change, people focus more on protein-rich diet, and that also brings the livestock into focus. So I think that's one of the reasons why we focused on this.
That was Noble Bananda, professor and chair of the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at Makerere University. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Kampala. And that's it for this Tuesday, July 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a very good day.